Nobody can be too Jewish.
That's exactly it. You got it.
Shalom and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest today is Aliza Lewin, president of the Louis D. Brandeis Center, discussing their work combating anti-Semitism on college campuses and their current lawsuit against Stanford University. We'll also have a visit from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Please email your comments to us at 2JewishRadio18@gmail.com. The opinions of the host and guests on 2 Jewish are their own and not those of the radio station. 2 Jewish is paid for by 2 Jewish radio programs and podcasts, Tucson, Arizona. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and 2 Jewish.
Shalom. I've been thinking about the way music is so intrinsically tied to the way that we experience religion. Jewish services are a bit different than many other religious traditions, in that our entire service traditionally is chanted rather than read. If you attend Orthodox or even conservative Jewish services, you will discover that the vast majority of the prayers are chanted. If you attend a contemporary Reform or Reconstructionist or Renewal or Progressive service, you may find that most of the service is sung through, accompanied by piano or guitar or a variety of other instruments. The public reading of prayers that is so typical of many religious traditions is actually alien to Jewish ritual experience. I once heard a popular Reform rabbi in a speech say, "Responsive readings in English are the invention of the devil." While there was a period in classical Reform Judaism when services imitated the practice of Christian Protestant traditions and included English readings, both solo and in responsive format, throughout Jewish history, our approach has nearly always been that words of prayer are far better sung than read, and our services have nearly always reflected that. There's a lot of music. It flows throughout the service, and there is comparatively little reading aloud. We recently invited some non-Jewish friends we met while scuba diving to attend a Shabbat service at my congregation, and they both seemed to really enjoy it. The music of the service, the sermon, and the Onig Shabbat afterwards. The social aspect that always follows services, and the food's always good. We are Jews. One of them expressed the experience by saying it was like a concert, a TED Talk, and dinner, all in one. I'm thinking about making that the tagline for our new Congregation Beit Simcha ad campaign, by the way, for my synagogue's fall marketing push. Look, the truth is that music makes words far more memorable. I'm pretty sure you cannot remember the words of very many speeches you have heard in your life. I think I can remember the whole Gettysburg Address, more or less, but that's one of the shortest great speeches on record, and I had to memorize it for a play I was in back in 11th grade, during which I was, believe it or not, Abraham Lincoln. Anyway, I might also remember a bit of the I Have a Dream speech of Martin Luther King Jr.'s, and, well, that's about it. It's hard to remember speeches, isn't it? They don't exactly stick in our brains. But I'm pretty certain that you, like me, can remember the lyrics of many of your favorite songs. I'm not particularly good at remembering lyrics, not even the ones I write myself, but I do know most of the words for every Simon and Garfunkel song, lots of Beatles songs, plenty of The Who and the Rolling Stones, a fair number of Eagles tunes, perhaps 50% of the Billy Joel songbook, some Elton John and Queen, nearly all the words to American Pie by Don McLean, that song's 8 minutes long, plenty of Broadway show tunes, too many pop songs from the 80s by the Bangles and the Go-Go's, Ironic by Alanis Morissette, The Highwaymen, King of the Road, a bunch of Bare Naked Ladies songs, some Linda Ronstadt, James Taylor, Carly Simon, Joni Mitchell, Crosby, Stills and Nash, Fleetwood Mac's entire Rumors album, a bunch of Taylor Swift songs my daughter made me listen to, many folk songs, a decent number of the classic American songbook tunes from the 30s and 40s, some Beach Boys, a little Buddy Holly, and a whole catalog of Israeli pop songs. Wow, that's a lot of lyrics. You see, music makes words memorable. There's a reason that the most popular narrative podcasts, even wonderful podcasts like, you know, Too Jewish, attract a mere fraction of the number of listeners of even ordinary pop songs. Music affects us not only by entertaining us, but by touching something deep in our spirit. And when we connect music with meaningful words of prayer, we can create something both beautiful and powerful. That is surely true of a Jewish Sabbath service done well. Now, tastes in music, synagogue music anyway, certainly change over time. The music that spoke to our parents isn't the same music that reaches us, nor is it likely to be the same music that'll work for our children, let alone our grandchildren. Some melodies will last a long time, others will just fade away. But to really create a Jewish Shabbat service that touches people and keeps on touching them every week, high-quality music is essential. I began my Jewish professional career as a cantor, and of course, although I have now been a rabbi for more than 25 years, I will always also be a cantor. It's not like you lose that, or that professional standing. And perhaps this gives me a greater appreciation for the centrality of music in Jewish religious life. The truth is that beautiful Jewish music should be a priority for every synagogue, because that's surely one of the most important aspects of preserving, maintaining, and deepening Jewish commitment and meaning. And so, on that theme to play us in this morning, here's one of my favorite compositions, my father's setting of the Hashkivenu, the evening prayer, Let There Be Love, with a solo by our own cantorial soloist at my congregation, Beit Simcha, Lindsay O'Shea. Only she sang this back when she was a young teenager.
Hashkivenu, Adonai Elokeinu, l'shalom.
Let there be love and understanding.
Amideinu malkeinu l'chayim.
Let there be peace. Let peace and friendship be our shelter from life's storm.
Let there be love. Let there be love. friendship be our shelter from life's storm.
Eternal God, help us walk with our companions to live with hope in our hearts and eternity in our thoughts. Let there be love.
Let us lie down in peace. Let us rise up to life and to light and to confidence. Let there be love.
That was the Hoshki Venu, Let There Be Love, sung by me and Lindsay O'Shea. We're going to return on to Jewish in a moment. Our guest, Aliza Lewin of the Louis D. Brandeis Center, will explain how they are fighting anti-Semitism on college campuses right now, and a lawsuit they've recently filed that involves severe anti-Semitism at one of the most prestigious universities in America. Hear all about it when we return in just a moment here on Too Jewish.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson. Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Congregation Beit Simcha, the House of Joy, a new Jewish synagogue in northwest Tucson in the Catalina foothills, celebrates a great array of services, classes, and events this summer. Established by passionate, caring congregants and me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, Beit Simcha has created a vibrant, vital community that strives every day to serve God with joy. A new progressive congregation in northwest Tucson and the foothills, Beit Simcha is open to everyone throughout the metropolitan area, providing weekly Shabbat services Friday night and Saturday morning, youth and adult education academy courses, social justice opportunities, outreach, and cultural Jewish programming. Beit Simcha's synagogue is located at 2270 West Ina Road, on the north side of Ina, just west of La Cholla, near the entrance to the Foothills Mall property in our own building. Services, classes, and events are open to everyone. Once again, join us in person Friday night and Saturday morning. Email me, rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org for more information, beitsimchatucson.org, or just show up. You can also join us every Friday night on our Facebook page for Shabbat evening celebration services at 6:30 p.m. and Saturday Shabbat morning services at 10 a.m., all with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, leading them. Facebook page is Beit Simcha Tucson, Beitsimcha Tucson. We will continue to hold our services with full music, both in person and by virtual experience, every Shabbat. All of our Adult Education Academy classes are live and also on Zoom. You can access those by emailing rabbi@beitsimchatucson.org, beitsimchatucson.org. Our wonderful religious school and Torah Tykes programs are available in blended formats as well, some students in person and some on Zoom, and we are registering right now for the fall. In fact, for more information about Congregation Beit Simcha to come to services, our great religious school and Torah Tykes program, bar and bat mitzvah, confirmation and high school programs, outreach, and rich array of adult education academy courses taught in person and also available online, and all of our services live and on Facebook Live, go to beitsimchatucson.org, www.beitsimchatucson.org, or call 520-276-5675. That's 276-5675. BeitSimchaTucson.org. Join me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, in the newest and fastest growing and most exciting Jewish community in all of Southern Arizona in its wonderful beginning years. We are delighted to welcome to Jewish our guest this morning. Aliza Lewin is the president of the Louis D. Brandeis Center, which addresses anti-Semitism on Jewish campuses and other kinds of issues related to it from a legal standpoint. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
Nice to have you. Do me a favor and briefly reintroduce the Brandeis Center to the two Jewish listeners.
Sure. The Louis D. Brandeis Center for Human Rights Under Law is an independent, nonpartisan organization. It's a legal advocacy group. Our mission is to advance the civil and human rights of the Jewish people and promote justice for all. I'm the president of the organization. I have been serving as president for about 3 years. The organization was started about 10 years ago by Ken Marcus, a civil rights attorney, who I took over for him as president when he went to the to head the Office of Civil Rights in the Department of Education. He served, this was his second stint now during the President Trump's administration as the Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights in the Department of Education. And one of the main focuses of the organization is using legal tools to try and combat anti-Semitism, particularly in the area of higher education. And so I talk almost every single day to students on campus who are experiencing anti-Semitism. And what we do is we work with them to help them articulate what's happening to them to in using the legal language, really, of harassment and discrimination so that the administrators understand that they face potential legal liability if they don't take steps to try and address that harassment and discrimination.
I was just going to say, this seems like...
If we can't resolve these things in a more informal capacity or the students can't get relief, then sometimes it escalates. And sometimes we end up needing to actually file formal complaints with the Office of Civil Rights, or as we may get to recently, we filed a complaint with the EEOC on behalf of some employees at Stanford University. But that's the basic work of the Brandeis.
Sure, and we'll talk about Stanford, I think, later in the show. I just want to note, this seems to be an unfortunately fertile time for anti-Semitism on campus. Is that just... is that just a media impression, or has this been going on for a long time? It seems appreciably worse right now.
It is getting worse. Ken Marcus founded the organization a decade ago because he saw the trend, but in recent years, it has escalated tremendously. And you're right. It's an increasing problem.
We will talk much more with Aliza Lewin, the head of the Louis D. Brandeis Center, and about anti-Semitism on campus, and in particular the Stanford lawsuit, when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or akvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. That's TOOJewishRadio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website, twojewishradio.com, streaming us from there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in North America, according to Moment Magazine, well over 100,000 downloads on Podbean. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, we talked about the Jews of Sicily for several Two Jewish episodes over the last few weeks, radio shows. Not far from Sicily is the major Italian city of Naples, which was really a totally different kingdom for a long time. Jewish life goes back there a long way. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's interesting because the histories of Naples and Sicily are very closely interlinked. And for many centuries, there was something called the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, which was one state that had sort of two capitals, a political capital in Palermo and an economic commercial capital in Naples. And for much of their history, they really went through parallel phenomena, like they were both part of Greater Greece, Magna Graecia. Both have a lot of Greek ruins.
Because of the original Greek city-states that were founded as colonies in
right.
those areas?
Well, Naples, and the reason we call people from Naples, Neapolitans, was originally Neapolis, new city in Greek.
Right.
And it was founded by the Greeks many centuries before the advent of Christianity. And it was a totally Greek-speaking city and a highly cultured city. So one of the funny things for me is when most Americans hear Naples or Sicily, they think about the mafia or La Camorra or whatever, Cosa Nostra. They think about crime and slums and poverty. Naples historically is anything but that. It did go through a bad period earlier in the 20th century. So those of us who grew up in the 20th century suffered from what may have been a temporarily accurate idea of Naples, but is historically wildly inaccurate. So also the countries are linked not only because they were politically one country for many centuries, that is to say Naples and Sicily, but in fact, all of southern Italy was at one point or another referred to as Sicily, not only the island of Sicily, and that included Naples. But the Neapolitans no longer for many centuries think of themselves as part of Sicily. And they have built a city with a real treasure of art, archaeology, incredible museums, old mansions of aristocrats. There was a lot of money there. One of the Rothschilds, the one who opened the Italian branch of the family business, settled not in Milano, which is today the capital of banking in Italy, not in Rome, which is the political capital of Italy, but in Naples, which was the commercial and business capital of Italy. It was sort of the New York as opposed to the DC of Italy before Italy was Italy.
Right.
So for centuries, Naples was important enough in the business world that when the Rothschilds decided to open a branch in Italy, that's where they did it.
Huh. And obviously, if the Rothschilds were there, there had to be a significant Jewish community.
Yes. And we can talk about the Jewish community and Jewish history of Naples maybe next week.
Sounds good. Thanks, Tom.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Izzy and Howard are brothers disliked by the whole community. They run crooked businesses, they lie, they cheat the poor, but they are also very, very wealthy. When Izzy died, his brother Howard went to Rabbi Bloom and said, "I will donate $1 million to the synagogue if at the funeral you say that my brother Izzy was a mensch." The rabbi thought long and hard, but eventually agreed. When it came time for the funeral, the rabbi recounted Izzy's wrongdoings during the eulogy at length. He then closed with the sentence, "But compared to his brother, he was a mensch." You see, a mensch is a decent human being, a good person. Never mind. That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week we read a portion from the latter section of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. It is named after a man called Pinchas, whose story really began at the end of last week's portion of Balak. The situation is familiar. For the umpteenth time, the people of Israel has been disobeying the Torah and worshiping other gods. This time, the apostasy has reached epidemic proportion. Even the elite leadership of the people have begun to sample the religious wares of the Midianite and Moabite priestesses. Finally, one of the princes of the people challenges the authority of Moses publicly by taking a sacred prostitute into his tent, while the whole assembly watches in horror. As Moses and the other elders stand by, shocked, unable to respond to such a chutzpahdik act, such a brazen violation of the basic laws of the community, a young Kohen, a priest named Pinchas, steps forward. He slays the wayward prince and his consort and breaks the spell of false religious practice. For this act, Pinchas is rewarded by God, which seems to validate his violent vigilantism. But there's more to the story than meets the eye. For Pinchas's reward for killing the couple is a brit shalom, a covenant of peace. Neither he nor any of his descendants is ever again permitted to go to war or to carry a spear. Pinchas must minister instead to the needs of the tabernacle, the rituals of the altar and of purification and sacrifice. He can never engage in any more acts of violence. He has broken the Israelites' latest fascination with paganism for sure, but never again will that level of religious violence be tolerated. It must instead be sublimated to serve the needs of the community, an ongoing lesson about the dangers of religious fanaticism. For ever since Pinchas' act, Judaism has refused to countenance the kind of religious insanity that led to the Crusades and to violent jihad and the Inquisition and other kinds of religious terrorism. In spite of the occasional anomaly, our religious fervor is never designed to lead to violence. We are committed, fervently and firmly, to the same brit shalom, the covenant of peace that God places on Pinchas. Religious commitment is essential, but religious violence is forbidden. So may it always be. And perhaps someday the rest of the world's religions will come to understand this teaching of Judaism also. When we return, Aliza Lewin explains how the Brandeis Center responds to campus anti-Semitism and just why recent events at Stanford University have risen to the level of lawsuits. And just what happened at Rutgers University recently, too. Find out when we come back on Too Jewish in just a moment.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Tensions ratcheted up between Israel and the Palestinians last week after incendiary devices were launched by Palestinian terrorists from Gaza, landing in Israel and lighting fields on fire. The Israeli Air Force struck targets in Gaza City and elsewhere in response. No injuries were reported, but in clashes on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem, some stone-throwing Palestinians were hurt when Israeli police responded to their attacks with sponge-tip bullets and flashbang stun grenades. In the West Bank, similar clashes took place near settlements, and again, minor injuries were reported. The ceasefire between Israel and Hamas has mostly held over the past few weeks since the Gaza War, but it is likely there will be continued tensions for some time to come. Some view these recent Arab incitements as tests for the new Israeli administration under Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. We will see how it goes. In American Africa, three Jewish nonprofit organizations will receive a slice of the latest $2.74 billion in grants handed out by Mackenzie Scott, the philanthropist and former wife of Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. Scott and her husband Dan Jewett announced last week that they were distributing new funds to 286 different organizations, bringing Scott's total charitable giving since July 2020 to $8.5 billion. The latest grants include Scott's first to Jewish groups. The three Jewish grantees are Maryland-based Hias, the advocacy agency that gives aid to immigrants and refugees; Repair the World, a community service and social justice organization based in New York; and Africa Tikkun, an aid organization founded by the chief rabbi of South Africa after the end of apartheid there. Because community-centered service is such a powerful catalyst and multiplier, we spent the first quarter of 2021 identifying and evaluating equity-oriented nonprofit teams working in areas that have been neglected, said Scott. We chose to make relatively large gifts to the organizations to enable their work and as a signal of trust and encouragement to them and others. Scott didn't spell out why she gave any particular group money or how much each had received. Repair the World, however, released a statement announcing a $7 million unrestricted gift from Scott that will help get more young people involved in community service and advocacy on humanitarian and civic issues. Mackenzie Scott and Dan Jewett's generosity and vision validates the investments of Repair the World's generous funders. And their gift is a clear challenge and invitation to do even more. More service, more partnerships, more investments to elevate and expand service in American Jewish life, said Cindy Greenberg, president and CEO of Repair the World. Meanwhile, Hias announced it had received a transformational grant from Mackenzie Scott. Hias has been broadening our programmatic advocacy and geographic reach to help people find safety, welcome, and opportunity wherever they are, said Mark Hetfield, a past guest of Two Jewish, the president and CEO of Hias. With this investment, Hias will accelerate our work to build the platform we need to respond to refugee emergencies wherever they arise and whenever we can help. In other news, the Reconstructionist movement has chosen a Jew of color to lead its rabbinical college, a first for a major American Jewish movement, if you think the Reconstructionists are major. Hebrew Bible scholar Amanda Bekenstein Mbuvi, who is black, will lead the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College outside of Philadelphia, the movement's umbrella organization, Reconstructing Judaism, announced last week. She will become vice president of academic affairs, the school's highest post, and report to Reconstructing Judaism CEO, Rabbi Deborah Waxman. Mbuvi is neither a rabbi, nor was she previously involved with the Reconstructionist movement. She did say in an online conversation that her formative experience of Jewish communal life had taken place in a conservative synagogue with a Reconstructionist rabbi. I think I know the synagogue, by the way, and the rabbi. Mbuvi said the diversity of the American Jewish community is important to reflect in rabbinical training, that her vision for rabbinic education is that it equips students to envision, embody, and bring forth new possibilities for the world, rooting them in Jewish tradition and equipping them to engage others in that tradition in all of the diverse embodiments and social locations that people are bringing to Jewish community now. The 44-year-old Mbuvi is currently a faculty member at High Point University, a liberal arts college in North Carolina, where she helped found the school's minor in Jewish studies. Mbuvi holds a PhD in religion from Duke and in 2016 published a book titled Belonging in Genesis, Biblical Israel and the Politics of Identity Formation. She grew up Jewish in the black church, she says. The Reconstructionist movement, which seeks to evolve its Jewish teachings to fit contemporary times on an ongoing basis, is by far the smallest of the four major streams of American Judaism. Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, of course, are the others. Mbuvi is the second Jew of color the movement has hired in recent months for a prominent position. In January, it brought on Rabbi Sandra Lawson, who had been the Hillel Rabbi at Elon University, also in North Carolina, to become its first ever Director of Racial Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews round the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Aliza Lewin is head of the Louis D. Brandeis Center, which addresses anti-Semitism on campus, doing so through discussion and raising awareness. And if that doesn't work, by filing suits with aspects of the federal government who deal with these problems. How does a case rise from, okay, there's anti-Semitism on campus, you're not addressing it, let's have a discussion, you send out some emails, if you're the administrator, you do a few things. How does that move from you're not doing enough? Like, when do you make that determination?
It really is dependent on the case and the circumstance. Usually what has to happen is the university has to be made aware of the harassment, the discrimination, and take no steps to address it. So one of the key laws that we utilize is what's called Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And Title VI requires all entities that receive any kind of government funding to protect their students from harassment and discrimination on the basis of race, color, national origin. And what this law was originally passed to try and protect against segregation. They wanted to make sure that all students had equal access to the educational opportunities provided by the university. What we are seeing today with increasing frequency is that Jewish students, particularly Jewish students who have an affiliation and connection to Israel, are increasingly being marginalized and ostracized and pushed out of student government, progressive clubs, the community and the society on campus. And so when the students show this and demonstrate this to the university has to take steps to educate their community, their broader community, on what anti-Semitism is. They have to condemn it, and they have to make sure that these students are able to participate fully in all of the university's activities and express their full identity while doing that. Right? The idea that you have to be on campus today, a Jew who hides or sheds his Jewish identity in order to feel welcome and in order to fully participate and fully engage, that's unacceptable. And if that's what's happening to students, then if the university doesn't, when it's alerted to this, take steps, we may, depending on the situation, feel that it needs to be elevated to the point where a formal complaint is filed.
So, you know, I'm familiar, I think all of the two Jewish listeners are familiar with various incidents at my alma mater, UCLA. The Jewish student was pushed out of student government because they were told they couldn't be objective since they were involved with pro-Israel organizations. That's the kind of thing that can probably be resolved administratively. And I hope, or you know, there was definite pressure from the university administration that, you know, this wasn't okay and so on. One of many incidents around the country of late. Tell us a little bit about one of the most prestigious academic institutions in America, Stanford University, and the situation that arose in its psychological counseling services there.
Sure. So at Stanford, like many universities across the country, last year they started what they called a diversity, equity, and inclusion program, which was supposed to train and educate their staff to adopt or recognize and take steps to make sure that they would be fully inclusive of all members of the Stanford community and that they would understand how to combat racism and any kind of discrimination. And so in the CAPS program, as you say, in the Counseling and Psychological Services program, which is the department of the professionals that provide mental health services to students on campus. So any of the students who need mental health support, these are the staff members that provide that support. They started running a DEI program. They had their own staff run the program. And there were Jewish staff members who ended up experiencing, as part of that program, severe and persistent anti-Jewish harassment. So they were pressured, for example, to join the DEI program's racially segregated whiteness accountability affinity group, even though they expressed their discomfort that they felt no affinity with white identity, right? The main overarching problem with this program was that it had no space. It had a blind spot when it came to Jewish identity. So there was no opportunity for the Jewish members to share their, first of all, the richness of their Jewish ancestral heritage, but even to also express the history that Jews have had of historic discrimination and oppression. If they tried to raise the issue of anti-Semitism ever, they were attacked. They were criticized. So for not only was the environment hostile for them personally, but when this group would talk about instances of anti-Semitism that took place on campus, the university would ignore them. The DEI program here in CAPS would ignore them. So, for example, there had been a Zoom bombing of a university town hall. And as part of the Zoom bombing, there had been images of swastikas that had been displayed on the screen, as well as anti-Black racist images, including use of the N-word. And when the DEI group in CAPS met to discuss this incident, they only focused and only discussed the anti-Black racist images. And when the Jewish members said, what about the anti-Semitism, they were told, no, we are only focusing on the racism. Jews are powerful. Jews are privileged. Jews, you know, we're not going to talk about that.
Jews are white and so on, right?
Months later, when more swastikas came up, they deliberately, they knew about it and made no time to discuss it. So they have been conscientiously denying and avoiding and dismissing any of the anti-Semitism that's taking place on campus.
So tell us about the Brandeis Center's response to this and how we got to where we've gotten to now.
So we were particularly concerned about this, not only because of the hostile environment for these two employees, but because we recognized that this presents a danger, really, and a risk to students on campus. Because if you're training your mental health professionals to deny or dismiss the anti-Semitism on campus, what kind of quality care are they going to be able to provide to students on campus who are experiencing anti-Semitism? And particularly in light of the spike in anti-Semitic incidents that we've seen across the country, and we know that students are in need of mental health support on campuses, this is detrimental and potentially very detrimental to students on campus. In fact, just recently, there was an email that went out from the Hillel director at Stanford, which noted that there were students on campus recently who had felt shunned. That there was one Jewish student who reported that after asking a question about a class assignment, another classmate said, "I'm not going to talk to you, Nazi." And in a different incident, there was a student who was reported saying, "Don't talk to me if you're Jewish." So if you have Jewish students on campus now who are feeling marginalized and excluded this way, and you've systematically trained your mental health professionals not to recognize or understand or be sensitive to anti-Semitism, how are they going to provide effective support for these students? So what we did is we filed a complaint on behalf of these employees, a discrimination complaint with the EEOC. That's what we publicized this week. It's been getting quite a bit of attention. And the next step in the process is the EEOC tries to see if the parties can, with the assistance of a mediator, resolve the matter. And so we're hoping to be able to engage with the university to get them first to fix this DEI program, but also there's a broader issue of anti-Semitism on campus. And in order to address that, the university is going to have to take steps to educate and inform its community on how anti-Semitism manifests today. And without, unless they take that step, they're not going to be able to effectively make Stanford a safe, welcoming environment for all students, including Jewish students.
Was there a sense that the higher levels of Stanford administration were unaware of this? Was there a sense that this was localized to that particular counseling center, which is highly influential, as you say, or did it feel more systemic?
So these two employees tried to raise this repeatedly over the last year with supervisors and then going higher up the chain, and they were repeatedly told, "We're sorry you feel this way. There's nothing we can do." It's not until the university became aware that we filed a complaint with the EEOC that they even began a formal investigation, which is just brand new. So it has not reached any kind of resolution yet. I think that the university, the statements they've made to the press, seem to acknowledge that there is a problem with this DEI program, because they've said that they're going to be looking into revamping it this summer. I think that, you know, we have not yet heard from other departments. One of the things that Stanford did is they had their own staff members run these programs. They did not, each department ran its own. So I don't know about the DEI program in other departments. I don't know if they had similar problems or not. We may yet learn that there were similar problems. But I have the sense from students and from certain articles that have been written and even in the student paper that there are Jewish students who have felt this this sense of being marginalized and ostracized, and I don't think that the university has fully appreciated that, and I'm hoping that this case raises their sensitivity and awareness to that and prompts them to take steps that will address it.
There was a recent incident at Rutgers University where they sent out a letter saying, you know, anti-Semitism is terrible. Rutgers might have the largest Jewish student body of any university in America. And then a day later, kind of retracted it because they hadn't been sensitive enough to the Palestinian concerns when they sent out this letter opposing anti-Semitism. That speaks to kind of a larger challenge that I think not only the Brandeis Center, but all Jews on campus must face, which is there's this weird association that you can do anti-Semitic acts if you're angry about something that's happening in Israel. How would you recommend we address that kind of thing?
There's so much in the question you just asked. First of all, let's just talk about it. I think that the Rutgers example is a very powerful example of what universities should not do. And it's a lesson learned, right? Here the university did what they should do. They tried to protect their Jewish students by issuing this condemnation of the anti-Semitism that was taking place. That was the right step. And then...
By the way, I must add that statement included we're opposed to any kind of racism, gender inequity, all of that. You know, it was a broad statement.
We oppose all hate against all people was really the subsequent statement. Is they issued a fairly good, you know, good statement condemning the anti-Semitism and then got attacked by Students for Justice in Palestine because they felt that it was not a statement recognizing the Palestinian students. So that's when the university essentially took back its original condemnation of anti-Semitism, apologized for not having included Palestinians, and condemned essentially all hate against all people. And that then was criticized again by Students for Justice in Palestine, who said, you didn't go far enough. You have to adopt BDS. You have to condemn, you know, all the immoral activities of the government of Israel. And so the lesson to be learned is what I think is the answer to your question, which is our community has to understand that Israel and the Jewish people have real enemies. Okay, there are groups that have stated clearly and repeatedly that their goal is the destruction of the one and only Jewish homeland. That's Hamas, Hezbollah, Iran, very clear. They make no qualms. They have no qualms about saying it, and they say it boldly. There are others who don't sound as militant, but who also don't believe that the Jewish homeland has a right to exist as a Jewish homeland. They don't believe that the Jewish people have a right to self-determination. That is also calling for the end of the State of Israel. And there are plenty of Jews, and you can see it in this last election, even in Israel, or the whole series of elections that led up to this. There are plenty of people who are critical of certain policies of the current government of Israel. That's not anti-Semitism, right? Seeking to improve the government and say, I have a different position and I would like to reform the current policies of the current government in order to ultimately, I hope, lead to peaceful coexistence, fine. But if your criticism of Israel is intended to destroy the one and only Jewish state, that's where we cross the line. And that's the problem. The problem is that so many people don't understand that distinction. They don't appreciate that it's one thing to say, let's have a debate about policy. It's a totally different thing to say, you know what? I don't believe the Jewish homeland has a right to exist at all. The latter is anti-Semitic. The former is not.
I want to thank Aliza Liu, and I feel like we could go on a good deal longer, but we are out of time. Where can people go to find out more about the Louis D. Brandeis Center and your work?
Sure. You can reach us. Our website is brandeiscenter.com, and you can reach us at info@brandeiscenter.com. And you should know we have law students who we train to help advise and guide undergraduates. So if there are any law students out there interested in being trained, that's our Jigsaw Fellowship program. They can apply to us. If there are undergraduates who need our assistance, they should reach out That's info@brandeiscenter.com.
Thank you so much. And thank you for the great work you're doing.
Thank you very much.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical play out.
We are the soul of Tucson. We are your neighbors and friends. Our commitment to provide the very best relies on the finest products and services you, our community, has to offer. Together, we make Tucson thrive. When we win, you win. Casino del Sol, the soul of Tucson.
Enterprise of the Pasquayaki Tribe.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next week for a special program on Jews of Color, Challenges and Reality Today. Our guests will be Nate Looney, the manager of racial justice initiatives at Avodah, and Gina Green, partner and chief strategy officer at Uprise. Our playout this morning is Steve Scher's Dodi Li, sung a while back by cantor Steve Scher, Ricky Lippitz, and Rabbi Joe Black. That song used at my wedding this past week as part of the processional. Hope you like it. And don't forget, you can join us at Congregation Beit Simcha this very Friday night for services and Oneg Shabbat in person or on Facebook, all starting at 6:30 p.m. Saturday morning too at 9 a.m. for Torah study, 10 a.m. for services and Torah readings. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of health and of peace.
Thank you. Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.